And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
Well, it's been an amazing week. I am recording this on Sunday after the AAII conference, as I've got a really busy schedule the early part of the week. And I mention that because there are some things I don't know at this point that I wish I did. And that is, after having had the good fortune of being part of this conference, along, by the way, with Chris Pedersen, and he did an amazing job both in being on the Factor panel with Jack Vogel and with Larry Swedrow. It was really a tremendous 1 hour of information from those three. I had an opportunity to talk about my favorite subject, small cap value, and to participate on a panel with Christine Benz and Roger Young. Roger is from T. Rowe Price, and that was all about investing and retirement. So that was a lot of fun, and I really hope that we helped a lot of folks with that information. Now, one of the reasons I wish I could have waited for a few days to do this is because I'm going to find out what access we're going to have to sharing at least the work that Chris and I did with you. I don't know what the cost of the video package is going to be, but I'm sure it will be fair. And from what I saw, it was an amazing opportunity to learn, and I'm going to recommend it. But I want to watch the whole thing and for myself and talk to you about the highlights of that series. And I certainly have to note that the honor that I was given for excellence in investment education was one of the nicest things that's happened to me in all the years of the working on teaching investors how to do the best they can. That is what we are about and will continue to be about. It was also a memorable week because in 2005, Rich and I wrote a book entitled Live It Up Without Outliving Your Money. And in that book, I noted two people who had motivated me to work hard after my retirement. Not, in essence, maybe let's say never to retire. And they were quite an inspiration. And sadly, both of them passed away in the last few months. And this last week, I was part of memorial services for both of those wonderful, inspiring people. Dr. Lynn Staley, who went on after he retired from Children's Hospital, went on to found the Global Help that I have been on the board for 20 years trying to spread medical literacy to developing nations. And Dr. Thaddeus Spratlin, who was a college professor who became a lifelong friend, he did marvelous work in working with minority business people with a program that was first established here in the Seattle area and then was taken national. But he was an inspiration to me all of my adult life. So Sunday rolled around, and I got up early and decided to watch a approximately 1 hour frontline documentary about, in fact, the title was The Retirement Gamble. And I will tell you that it was unbelievably frustrating to me. It made, by the way, the cases that the case we have made about the importance of fees and about the importance of diversification and about the importance of indexing versus active. But it highlighted to a point that I wanted to jump through the screen. It highlighted the outright lies that the industry shares, promotes, regarding the differences between active and passive. They use some old interviews with John Bogle about the implications of expenses and other things that impact the investor in terms of their long-term returns. What was just infuriating is when they interview people in the industry at high levels of responsibility, when asked, have you read the studies about the importance of fees, expenses, and mutual funds, and the implication of that as it relates to active management versus passive and the long-term return? And the answer? The answer is no, I've never seen those. I've never seen those studies. I mean, they pursued that a couple of, I'm certainly not aware of those studies. Common sense makes me believe that in an industry since 1976 has been talking about the fees and expenses and the diversification of indexes and the returns of indexes and the results of index funds versus active management, you cannot tell me there is anybody in the industry that is not aware. As a matter of fact, every kid who has been through a financial literacy course in high school knows about it. Almost every book that I've read about investing for the first time investor talks about this topic. And Rich Buck and myself, wrote a book basically on this topic. And the book is entitled Get Smart or Get Screwed: How to Select the Best and Get the Most from Your Financial Advisor. And the book talks about all the different ways that you can be fooled by the industry if you don't take the time to get the education, because I saw it. I saw it this morning. I saw somebody, in fact, several people, deny the existence of that premium for lower expenses. And in the discussion of a fiduciary and non-fiduciary, the people from the industry who've been fighting the requirement for all people who are helping people with retirement investing to play the role of fiduciary, they do not want to have that responsibility because it sucks a lot of the profits out of the work that they do. And so what they say is, well, there's a time for a fiduciary and there's a time when you don't need to work with a fiduciary. And so we don't want to require everybody to act in the best interest of the investor. And so people in an industry are allowed to continue to, when I say rape and pillage, that's an overstatement, but I will tell you this. When you listen to the people who have been misled with information on this show and what it has done to their life, you understand the importance of having this kind of responsibility for the people who are guiding people through that project. If there was one thing that was unfortunate as far as I'm concerned, it is the fact that not once did they mention target date funds and what target date funds can do for people to put them on the right path, keep them on the right path, and probably produce a much better return than people trying to do it on their own. Because those people trying to do it on their own, so often what happens is they are attracted to the market when it's doing well, and then it collapses, and then they look for safety. And we have to do everything we can to stop that from happening. I hope, if you haven't read it before, that you will take a look at the free. It's a free book that we offer. It's a PDF that you can get. Yes, you can buy the book at Amazon, but it's free through our website. And in the notes to this podcast, we have that link. I just want to take a second to when I say tease you, to let you know what this book covers. It talks about the different kinds of advisors and different kinds of responsibility. And then it does ask you to follow the money so you get a sense of how people are compensated. And then talks about how advisors typically work, some by commission, some by the hour, some as a percentage of assets. And then it talks about how to choose, what to ask, a long list of questions. You probably won't ask them all, but you might think to ask some that you hadn't thought of, and how to find a financial advisor. And then what you could or should get from your advisor, because they're trained, if they're any good, to do a lot of things they won't do for you unless you ask. And then I focus on the many ways that you can get screwed by the financial community, because it's a very tricky business. I talk about getting screwed by sales pressure, by conflicts of interest, by bad ethics, bad information, bad products, and then by emotional appeals. Now, that's a big one, and I'm going to read from that chapter in this podcast, and I'm not being lazy and just reading out of an old book. No, the reason I'm picking this particular chapter is because we know, and I've said this many times, when it comes to sex and food and money, these are not intellectual decisions. They are emotional decisions. And the industry, they understand that. So those people who are trying to maximize their income also want to maximize the education of the salespeople to learn how to, and I'll use the word, manipulate the customer or the prospect, to manipulate that relationship so that they make a sale. So here goes, chapter 16, Get Screwed by Emotional Appeals. Any successful salesperson learns early that buying decisions are much more often made on the basis of emotions than on the basis of logic and reason. Security salespeople have devised many ways, some of them pretty sneaky and sleazy, to manipulate investors into doing things that will make money for the sales force, but not necessarily for the investor. It won't surprise you to know that brokers' training often includes the notion that investors buy the sizzle, not the steak. Your broker doesn't want to bore you with lots of facts about a company, its products, and its competition. He wants to get you excited and thus in a buying mood. Salespeople know that we human beings are hardwired in a way that leads our intellectual functions to quickly give way when our emotions kick in. This, Wall Street knows, is the level on which most financial decisions are made. In this chapter, I'll give you 11 examples that may help you recognize when this could be happening to you or somebody you care about. 1. Brokers want and need clients who will be loyal to them, and the industry knows that that's just where to start, family and friends. Imagine that you're a young broker and you have just completed your training and have your license. Now you can begin to sell. Almost certainly, your first assignment will be signing up your friends and family members as clients. These are the people who will most likely to give you their trust and to want to help you to get started. It sounds lovely on the surface, but it's filled with danger for the friends and family members. Every young broker is bound to make mistakes. If you're the broker, do you want to make those errors with friends' money and your family's money? If you're a friend or family member, do you want to take this risk? Virtually every good financial expert I know believes people should be extremely cautious about loaning money to friends and relatives. I believe the same caution should apply to taking the advice of a brand new broker, even if he's a friend or family member. Your broker, this is number two, your broker has been taught that he will be more successful if you think of him as your friend. You'll naturally be greeted with a smile whenever you meet, and you'll be treated as an important person. This is standard for sales of all types. There's always an ulterior motive, and most of us have learned to expect that from salespeople. Chances are high that your broker will want to get to know about you, your family, your work, your favorite activities, your beliefs, your aspirations, and so forth. Sometimes you might get a call that's carefully designed to make you think your broker's friendship is genuine. One broker told me, quote, "I make a point of calling clients once in a while just to check in and see how they're doing without making any sales pitch. That way they'll learn that I'm not always calling to sell them something. That makes it more likely they will take my call when I need to sell them something." Number three, you might be shocked to learn what your broker really thinks of you. Privately, many brokers regard themselves as vastly superior to their clients, and often they use openly derogatory terms to describe the very people they work hard to butter up. The book described by Paul Farrell urges salespeople to remember that they are the professionals and their clients are just amateurs. The message is this: don't let the amateurs take over the sales process. Wall Street Journal columnist Jason Zweig once published a list of some of the terms he heard brokers use to describe their clients. The list includes chumps, suckers, marks, targets, victims, dupes, baby seals, guppies, pigeons, geese, ducks. As in, when the ducks quack, feed 'em. Cattle, sheep, and lambs to be shorn. Your broker may treat you as a very important and intelligent individual, but once you walk out the door or hang up the phone, he might use some of those words to describe you as he brags to his colleagues about what he persuaded you to do. The result is that your broker is pretending to have a relationship with you that is false. If you heard his private conversations about you, any trust you had in the broker could vanish in a heartbeat. Number four, in an earlier chapter, I spoke about my experience getting taken in by the notion that Jack Sikpa, who was then a celebrity in Seattle, was investing in a certain product. I loved the fantasy of thinking I was doing what Jack was doing. The reality was altogether different. If a broker can't hook you with an emotional appeal based on a celebrity, maybe a great story will do the trick, since investors love to own stocks with appealing stories. Story stocks are typically those of companies that are developing something, some hot new product or line of business. Think of a new smartphone or tablet computer, for example. Often the company itself is very new, giving investors a chance to get in on the ground floor. These appeals are easy to make because investors invariably hope they can ride the wave of the next Apple or the next Google. Peter Lynch, a legendary former manager of Fidelity's giant Magellan Fund, once said he had never made any money on a story stock. If he can't do it, what makes individuals think they can? I think the answer is that hope springs eternal. I hate to throw too much cold water on your hopes and dreams, but you need to know how Wall Street really works. If the story about a company is true and it's about to launch the next dynamite product or service, that fact will be well known. In-the-know investors will probably have already made their bets. On the other hand, if the story isn't true, how are you supposed to find that out? And does the story adequately include the things that could go terribly wrong? In 2012, millions of investors were starstruck by Facebook, which raised an unprecedented amount of money in its initial public offering. A few months later, the company's stock had lost nearly half its value. I have to just interject here. This book was written in 2011. So obviously, that was one that people did make a whole bunch of money. Number five, brokers would quickly go broke if they were completely honest and told you the unvarnished and complete truth about a stock they are recommending. To do that, your broker might have to say something like this: I am recommending this because I believe the price is likely to go up. However, many other people have known about this stock for some time, and they have had the opportunity to buy it for less than its current price. In fact, some of those early investors are trying to sell right now to lock in their gains. Today's price reflects everything that millions of smart investors know about the company. Although I'm very high on this stock, it's impossible to know the future of this or any other company. Many people think this company has a wonderful future ahead of it. Others think it's not likely to do much for investors. Still others think it's headed for big trouble. That's how the market works. There's just no way to know the future. Would that be an effective sales pitch? Hardly. Number six, if stories and celebrities aren't enough to spur a client into action, there's always urgency or the false sense of urgency. This urgency might be built on the notion of scarcity. If you are a broker and your firm has only 1,000 shares left of some hot initial public offering available to clients without paying the usual sales commission, your client can't afford to dawdle over the decision. It's easy to train a broker to say, if you want to get in on this deal, you better make your decision now. This implies that the stock in question is certain to be worth a lot more in the near future. Unfortunately, that certainty is always a myth, and that's why it's never put in writing. 7. Brokers sometimes get us to override our common sense by appealing to our vanity. They know that we want to think of ourselves as smarter than average. After all, we have picked a smarter than average broker, and we've beaten the averages by saving some money that's available for investment. What's more, our broker treats us as if we're special. So why should we settle for an investment that is just average? This is a good sales pitch for your broker to use when he wants to sell you actively managed mutual funds, those with managers who have a strategy for beating the market. It doesn't matter that dozens of academic studies reveal that relatively few active managers actually beat the market, nor does it matter that those funds have above-average expenses and above-average turnover. And the cost that you pay, regardless of whether the manager is a success or a failure. Your broker may tell you that passively managed index funds will force you, obviously somebody who is above average, to settle for only average returns. In fact, this is a subtle lie that most brokerage clients find easy to accept. Index funds capture the return of an asset class. For example, the Standard & Poor's 500 Index, without trying to beat that return. That's accepting the market, but it's not the average return. Average would represent the actual returns of all investors in a particular asset class. The majority of investors underperform the asset class, the index, because of expenses and mistakes of active management. And of course, because of the tendency of investors to make emotionally based decisions about when to buy and when to sell. As a result, the average investor winds up with much lower returns than those of index funds of comparable levels of risk. Here's what that means. If you invest in an index fund, you are virtually guaranteed to get an above-average return. If you buy an actively managed fund, your return is likely to be below average. Your broker certainly understands this, and he'll never tell you. That might make you feel gloomy instead of cheerful, and it would get in the way of making the sale. Number 8, impatience is one of the biggest enemies of investment success. But brokers need this very impatience in order to keep generating sales. I'm convinced that long-term investment success results from finding a good strategy, then patiently sticking to it over a long period. Think of the difference in mentality between a hunter and a farmer. A hunter is someone who ventures into the unfamiliar world looking for opportunity that could be captured. The hunter loves the excitement of the chase and is willing to take the risks that go along with it. The problem, of course, is that when you go hunting, really bad things can happen. A farmer, on the other hand, is somebody who is content to plant a field of crops, carefully tend that field, and then patiently wait for nature to take its course. Brokers prefer clients who think like hunters, clients who want quick results and crave emotional stimulation. Wall Street wants to make a ton of money from clients like these. A registered investment advisor, by contrast, has much more of the mentality of a farmer. His professional life isn't nearly as exciting as that of a broker, and his pay is likely to be lower than that of a high-producing broker. Number 9. Some brokerage operations are known as pump and dump shops or bucket shops. They are designed specifically to prey on unsuspecting investors who are willing to believe that it's easier for a stock price to go from 10 cents to a dollar than it is for the price to go from $1 to $10 or from $10 to $100. Their offerings tend to appeal to the investors looking for quick, easy wealth. Pump and dump brokers know that we'd like to be treated as big shots, and we will feel much more important if we own 100,000 shares than if we own only 100. The inescapable truth is that 100,000 shares that sell for 2 cents each are worth exactly the same as 100 shares selling for $20 each. But I have run into many people over the years who seem to love to be able to brag they own 100,000 shares of some company. It makes them seem like the big hitters. Brokers take advantage of this by selling them very cheap stocks. These are known in the industry as penny stocks. They are usually associated with extreme get-rich-quick hopes and stories, and they usually are beneficial only to the professionals who sell them and who sometimes earn commissions or markups as high as 50%. A broker, and this is number 10, a broker who wants to keep your business knows he needs to provide peace of mind. Feigned friendship is one way to provide it. Another is creating a false sense of security. When an investor's portfolio is doing poorly in a declining market, the broker is likely to say, "You're doing fine. Don't worry about it. Your investments are worth a lot more than they're selling for. You just have to be patient." That is a message that all investment clients like to hear. But coming from a broker, that message might really mean something like, "I know you're losing money, and I'm worried that you will panic and take your business somewhere else. Please, please, please just stick with me for a while, and if we are lucky, maybe things will improve enough that I'll be able to sell you some more things." 11. Brokers themselves are sometimes duped by product salespeople and even the firms they work for. In June 2012, Alan Stanford was sentenced to 110 years in prison for a $7 billion scheme that lasted over two decades and involved fake bank certificates of deposit. Stanford owned a broker-dealer firm which had 31 U.S. offices that sold the CDs, promising interest of 2 to 4 percentage points higher than what was available at the real banks. Naturally, these were easy to sell, and the firm raised a lot of money. The brokers who did the selling didn't have a clue that most of the money they raised was going straight to Stanford himself to fund his lavish lifestyle. They didn't have a clue that anything at all was fishy, even though any fifth grader might have asked where the extra 4% return was going to come from. Most investors in these fake CDs lost their money, and they got no help from their brokers, who earned huge commissions selling these phony products, and who fought vigorously in court to avoid having to give those commissions back. This illustrates one of my favorite quotes from John Bogle. "It's amazing how difficult it is for a man to understand something if he's paid a small fortune not to understand it." And in a very short afterword, I say, if you've made it all the way through Book 2, this is the whole part that has to do with how people are misused by brokers. I'll say, if you have made it all the way through Book 2 and you are, unfortunately, likely to either disbelieve what I've written or come away with feelings of disgust and distrust of the brokerage industry. As I wrote in the foreword to these last 6 chapters, my intention is to educate you so you can make informed, smart decisions about whom you hire to help you with your investments. To be a successful investor, you have to place your trust in people, in products, and in the future. This entire book has been focused on the people part of that equation. My final advice is simple. Trust, but trust warily, knowingly, and carefully. In these pages, you have the tools to do that, and I wish you nothing but success. And by the way, not everybody who's a broker is a scoundrel, and I think that's important. A lot of them, by the way, according to a very dear friend of mine who was with Merrill Lynch for many years, he would say that about a third of the brokers he worked with were competent and ethical, and another third were incompetent, but well-meaning. They wanted to do the best, but they just were incompetent. And another group were the people who were both incompetent and unethical. And by the way, I don't care whether you end up with somebody who wishes you all the best but is incompetent, or you have somebody who is both incompetent and unethical. They both can do a lot of damage, one in the best interest of their own pocketbook, and other with your best interest, but without the education and experience to do what's right for you. And yes, I do wish you the best, and I wanted to ask for a favor, if I might. Many of you, I see, have purchased the new book from Chris Patterson about two funds for life, and one of you have taken the time to go write a review at Amazon. I really would like those of you, when you finish the book, to take a few minutes and write a review. If there are things about the book you didn't like, I'm not asking you to lie on behalf of Chris Patterson, but I will tell you that those reviews mean a lot to people who come to consider buying the book. And if you read it and you can identify the kind of investor that should have that information, I hope you'll say so. And hopefully you will find it not only a good read, but I will tell you, the work that Chris has put into this without a penny of profit to try to help people is enormous. And I think you'll see that when you read the book. As always, good luck and thanks for being here. We are absolutely committed to do the best. As a matter of fact, this is a big week coming for us because five of us are getting together around a table and talking about how can we do more for you in this coming year. And you're getting this. Some of you will get this on Wednesday morning this week. And that afternoon, we have the meeting. Take a second, email me, paul@paulmerriman.com, and tell me what you'd like to see us do to help you. Remember that our focus is, one, on helping you select the right equity asset classes, two, helping you think through and determine how much of those different equity asset classes should you have in each. Number three, at some point as you age, you need to hopefully have some fixed income in your portfolio. So how much in fixed income? How much in equity? And then we have the distribution question. How should we take money out of our investments in retirement? And a separate focus is how much to take out in retirement. And finally, something that takes everything into consideration, the all-important glide path. I think it would be wonderful if a person could put together a portfolio and have it be built to serve you the best that it can over a lifetime, making changes as you age and have or should have less risk tolerance. The Target Date Fund will do that for you. And of course, you know that we believe you can do better than a Target Date Fund if you're willing to take some more risk. And so we are here to help you establish that long-term glide path that is built to make you more than a Target Date Fund. and try to minimize the amount of work that it takes. So there you have it. We're here to help, and I'm very excited about the meeting in the afternoon on Wednesday. We've been meeting for a long time now on Zoom, and it will be a ball to be eyeball to eyeball with people we appreciate so much. Thank you.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.